Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And once again, I'm going to have to go into my sound effects vault and dig out that bell ringing sound. There it is, right there. Because it's time for us to have another argument. The reason I left the pause there, Jem, is every time I've said that so far, we've then carried on and I've tried to fit in the bell somewhere. So, left the pause for this time. And this is always the fun part for me. Whenever we agree to have one of these little arguments on air, one of the things we never do is tell each other what way we're going to argue or who we've come up with. And I think this has gone wrong for us once before.
Only once.
Once, when we both managed to select the same person and we ended up just changing it to an episode all about that person. So this is the fun bit. This is where we find out whether we've got a real battle on our hands or whether it's all just going to be a little bit strange. Jim, what?
Well,
first of all,
should I tell people
argument?
The topic? Yeah,
yes.
I'll tell everybody the topic, then you can say your contender. Okay, is that fair?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, all right. So, people, this is who was the greatest warrior king. Now, they don't have to be king. They could be an emperor, for example. But what they absolutely have to be is royalty. It's not a general. And the other thing about warrior king is this isn't somebody who just led armies. This is somebody who actually could feel the breath of the enemy in their face, as it were. This is somebody who was swinging a sword or shooting a gun. This is somebody who was in the thick of battle, okay, as a king or emperor. That's the idea. There's nothing tricksy about this one, but this is why somebody like Napoleon won't be in it, because he wasn't royalty, but also he wasn't fighting tooth and nail. He was leading the armies from a safe distance, as it were. So, Greg, who is your choice?
Well, I've gone in a slightly odd direction with my particular choice, because my warrior king is someone who's probably most famous for losing a battle.
Okay.
I have gone for King Leonidas I.
Ooh,
of Sparta.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm going to go for Edward III, King of England.
I like that. We've gone very, very different there. I like it when we're
separated by nearly 2,000 years as well.
And two entirely different countries. You see, I kind of deliberately, the first thing I did was I took out of my head any English ruler, because I was pretty convinced that you were going to go for some obscure person from the middle of nowhere. And I thought, if you do some obscure person from the middle of nowhere and I turn up with, Richard III or somewhat, then I would just be completely big. Now, I also, for a second, was going to go with Alfred the Great, and then I thought, no, I spend so much time having a go at Alfred the Great, I can't go that way at all. So,
I thought you might have gone the way of Richard the Lionheart.
Yeah, you know I'm not a big fan of Richard the Lionheart, except for that one moment where he's on the stretcher, ill, can't stand, and is lying there in a stretcher with a crossbow shooting over the troops. I do like that bit. That's my favourite one. But he's not someone I'm bigging up today. So, Edward III, you say?
Yes.
Okay, so give us a quick rundown, just to reset me. Edward III, which one's that?
he was the third one. Edward was the man who started the Hundred Years' War, the so-called Hundred Years' War with France. He became king while his dad was either imprisoned and killed or exiled. There's still a bit of a debate about that one. So his mum, with her lover, was running the country, and basically Edward was under house arrest, and they basically had to be saved from a castle. There was an exciting breakout. I think it was Nottingham Castle, off the top of my head. And that's how he started his reign. And after that, he fought in a fair few battles. He even got wounded at one. So we're talking about somebody, I would argue, but sort of putting it out right now, the Battle of Thermopylae is probably one of the most famous last stands in history. So if you like, you've got perhaps the more famous battle. People might have heard of Crecy, most people won't have heard of Sluys, or indeed the fighting around Calais, which Edward was involved in. But I would retort by it's Edward fought in more battles, and oh yeah, the critical bit, he won them. So that if you like, to, that's my starting point. Over to you.
Well, what I particularly enjoy doing when I do this sort of thing is giving you a killer shot right off the start. So you're all focused on him losing his last battle. Okay, now I can come in underneath and see. Well, first of all, as you say, he was. You know, that battle is remembered today. And one of the things remembered about that battle is we talk about the Spartans, we talk about their power, and particularly we talk about the fact that they did fight. You know, this is the famous Battle of the 300, supposedly 300 men against thousands, and they stood. They wouldn't give up. They wouldn't back down. Now, one of the things about him is, and this is always one of the problems we have when we go a bit further back in history, which is why sometimes with these we tend to both go for slightly more modern people, is that the real facts of are sometimes a little bit muddied and everything else. We don't necessarily have all the information, but one of the first things I really do like about Leonidas was the fact that he was actually not supposed to be king. And there's always something of an extra element to a king who wasn't supposed to be a king, because they get that slightly different upbringing. Always makes me think of Henry VIII, who, when he was first born, wasn't supposed to be king. And they kind of get a little bit more freedom sometimes. Sometimes they get a little bit more power. Sometimes they get to actually interact slightly more with people. They get to live a slightly, not normal life, but whereas the heir to the throne is often much, much more protected. And because Leonidas was the second son of the previous king, this means he was never supposed to be king. He wasn't supposed to go on. And the first son of the king, the heir to the throne, was always excused the incredibly harsh Spartan military training system that every other male in the land had to go through. And you know, the Spartan warrior training system, the reason the Spartan warriors were so famous is because that training was brutal. It really, really was. They had to learn combat, but they were also taught.
Taken away from their mothers at the age of 7, they then had to live in barracks until the age of 18. And they then had to do 10 years military service on top of that. They were quite often starved, so that they had to learn how to steal, and were only punished if they were caught, because that was a sloppy job, not because the stealing itself was wrong. And would quite often kill helots, the slaves in Sparta. Indeed, the slaves were, that the Spartans themselves were outnumbered something like 101 to all the slaves who were doing the agriculture and all the stuff, while the Spartans themselves were doing all the fighting. So, sorry, I'm just jumping in there, just sort of pointing out, I absolutely agree, the Spartans had brutal training and were raised virtually from birth, or basically from the point of actually knowing what they could do, you know, into warriors. So yes, Leonidas was a there's no argument he was a fierce warrior, absolutely, but please continue.
That's right. So he became this very, very fierce warrior, and yeah, like you say, in one of the tests they had the test where they basically just take you out and abandon you, and you had to get back to the barracks. You know, this is so in that way, I think if we are looking for a warrior who is a king, you know, and we use the word warrior, not just someone that's a king that goes and does some battles and stuff, you know, that does a little bit of fighting in a 100 Years' War. I mean, what's the 100 Years' War? That goes on for ages. If we're looking for someone who is trained as a warrior king in the, and for me, it's also that sense of warrior king. You know, if I think of, to use a modern popular reference, Game of Thrones, if I think of Game of Thrones, of which I saw the first series or so, if I was to pick a warrior king out of that, it would be the big one whose name is now, as soon as I've said that, has entirely escaped me. Jem, do you watch Game of Thrones?
I do. So, but the big one, are you talking about Robert Baratheon, the guy who dies?
No. The real warrior one, the one that's out with the tribe. The one that Daenerys is married off to.
Okay, yes, Khal Drogo.
Khal Drogo, that's it, Drogo was... and he is, to me, you know, the others are kings, they're all manipulating, they're formulating, they're coming up with their plans and their schemes, and they're using the politics and tactics, whereas he, for me, is a real warrior king. He is, right, let's go out, let's get this battle done, let's do it, that is a warrior king. I don't say that makes him the best ruler, necessarily, but as a warrior king, that's why I'm kind of putting my flag on Leonidas.
Okay, well, if this was the argument about who was the toughest, I would agree. But, you know, the greatest is about fighting. And the one battle Leonidas is famous for is the Battle of Thermopylae. Whereas Edward, either in them or around them, fought in multiple battles. So the first pivotal battle in the Hundred Years' War is largely forgotten, but it was super important. It's the Battle of Sluys, where, and this predates the Battle of Crecy by a few years, where, in essence, what Edward realised was, so this shows strategic thinking, the French could attack and invade England at any point, so why don't we hit the French fleet while it's in a port? So he sent an English fleet, which he led himself, into the port of Sluys, and there was vicious fighting on the ships, and basically the English were able to destroy and neutralize the French fleet. And that is why during the Hundred Years' War, A, it was never an issue of could the English ship their troops over to France, and B, the reason why you didn't have rampaging French forces in southern England. That's how important that battle was. And it wasn't just down to, oh, you know, the longbow saves the day. There was vicious hand-to-hand fighting. Longbows are only so effective when people have got things like ships to hide in. So it was ship-to-ship fighting, hand-to-hand fighting. He actually got a crossbow bolt through his leg, so that shows you how much he was involved in the fighting. He obviously survived and recovered from that. And so, you know, I think that shows tactical nous, it shows bravery, it shows a huge importance to the strategy and the makeup of the Hundred Years' War leading on from that. It's a huge impact, and yet it's a battle that pretty much everybody's forgotten. Now, I'll come on to the more famous stuff later on, but what are your thoughts about that?
He's definitely a warrior. There's no question that we can't deny that he's a warrior. But, I mean, if you're going to take the fact that he got a bolt in the leg as evidence that he was, you know, a great warrior, then I'm going to question that in the same way that you would question me saying the fact that Leonidas died makes him a great warrior. You know, it means he got something wrong. But one question that I do want to come back to, because this is where I think you've got the upper hand on me, excuse me, almost certainly because of knowledge and because of facts, is when we look at...
Yeah, those important things, knowledge and facts.
Well, not knowledge and facts. Well, based on the fact that we don't know a lot about Leonidas' time as king before he got involved in the Persian Wars, and the famous final battle, we don't have enough. Whereas with Edward III, we have a lot of details about his actual rule as well. When we are talking about a warrior king, my argument is going to be it's all about the battle. It's all about the war. It's all about the fighting. And it's all about doing whatever it takes to save your people
to win
as well.
Are you going to use the W word?
No, I'm going to use to save your people, because my argument is that, you know, lose the battle to win the war, and that is something that Leonidas very much understood when he went into that final battle, and I'll come to that in a little bit. But just Edward as king, again, this is one of those reasons why I didn't go for Richard the Lionheart, because Richard the Lionheart spent all his time playing off, rushing away other countries, trying to go off and basically start a ruckus in the Crusades, which I'm pretty sure is exactly how you put it in Deus Vult. pretty sure that's a verbatim quote. And with Edward III, he's going off and he's fighting, but he's fighting in France, really for French lands. He's not fighting directly to protect the front line of England and what England is at that point in time. He's off in France, he's fighting a war. Whereas...
Oh, no, that's naughty. That's naughty. You know darn well that the English king owned about half of France as, like, you know, the Duke of Aquitaine or the Count of Anjou and et cetera, et cetera. And this has been a problem rumbling on for centuries where, you know, you're king in one country, but you're suddenly subordinate to the French king in another country, but all those lands are rightfully yours.
That is true. I know, I'm being a little bit cheeky there, but he is king of England. Let's not forget that that is where he's actually king of. But it comes down to the fact he's also pushing. He's not shy of fighting battles to expand either, is he? This is back and forth. As you say, this is a back and forth over who owns what territory in France, who owns what. Whereas the major battle of Leonidas was entirely defensive. He was a king, he was looking after his people, and he went out not to kill and save and conquer. He was entirely defensive. That was the moment when he put his all into battle, and he was prepared to sacrifice himself, essentially in a diversionary tactic, in order to save his country, as opposed to going off and thinking, not I'll protect my people, but I want to be king of that place. I'm going to keep going forward and being king. Yeah, I'm going to fight just to stay as a king of a bit of France. That's going to be my argument.
Okay, well, all he had to do with save himself and save his people was to give one jar of water and one jar of earth to the Persian government. I'd do that. You know, if you're going to raise the taxes, you might, you know, give them to Persia. And, you know, Persia is so far away that, you know, play ball for 10 years, then just say, we're not going to do it anymore. They'll find it very hard to raise the army and ship it over again a second time. But no, he decided to be obstinate about it. The Battle of Thermopylae is not in Sparta, so he was not defending his home ground. It was a Greek coalition, but it's worth remembering that very shortly after this, you have the Peloponnesian War, which was basically Sparta and Athens tearing at each other's throats. They hated each other just as much as England and France did. So, you know, if you're going to be cheeky about that, I think you know you're onto a losing streak here. Leonidas is more famous. Leonidas has had the more famous battle, but fundamentally it's a noble defeat, whereas Edward had some noble victories. And you can't really argue with that. If you go to the Battle of Crecy, again, that's hugely important in British history and just sort of history generally. It was the first time gunpowder was used on a battlefield in Western Europe. He brought in very early cannons. What's interesting is they were kind of bell-shaped, and rather than firing cannonballs, they fired really big arrows. They hadn't been able to go past arrows. Arrows are very important. If something's going to fly through the air, it's got to be an arrow, okay? So it fired really powerful arrows. Obviously, the longbowmen did a very good job there at the Battle of Crecy. So killing the King of Bohemia, and when his helmet, the King of Bohemia was blind, and he got his men to sort of lash their horses together so he could charge in the right direction. He and his men charged towards the longbowmen, and they were cut down. And then after the battle, his helmet was found, which had three huge ostrich plumes in it. And if you're thinking, oh, that sounds familiar, that's now the symbol of the Prince of Wales, because Edward's son, also called Edward, the Black Prince, was there at the Battle of Crecy. And his wing, where Edward's son was, was under pressure at one point. The French army had actually got to them. There was hand-to-hand fighting, and there was worries about, is that flank of our army going to fold? And he famously said, let the boy earn his spurs. So he recognized that the side would stand, and he managed to conduct, in essence, a massacre of the French army. The French were completely outclassed in terms of technology, but he was also very brave. And the other thing that most historians agree on is the reason why he chose Crecy is he grew up in that area. He knew the area well, and he knew he basically create a kill zone between the British forces, because there were Welsh archers there as well, the British forces and the French blithely just blundered into it. So with the Bohemians. So it was, you know, it was, again, we got an example of somebody being brave, but also somebody being tactical and somebody winning the day. It absolutely crushed the French. And then shortly after that, like 18 months later, then the Black Death hit both England and France. But France then had the double whammy of losing a large chunk of the aristocracy in a battle, and then more of the aristocracy through biological pandemics. And then in 10 years after the Battle of Crecy, you got the Battle of Poitiers, which admittedly Edward wasn't at, but by then the Black Prince was a very capable child, just real chip off the old block, who again annihilated a French army. So I'm not going to count that one because Edward wasn't there. But the last time Edward strapped on his armor was at Calais, when the French sort of like did a surprise attack on it. And Edward could have stood behind the walls and sort of, you know, undergone a siege, but instead he, with a handful, a retinue of troops, he was about 40 years old, ran out with his with the Black Prince. So a small group of English knights charged out the front of Calais. It caught the French by surprise, who actually heavily outnumbered them and thought this was the front of an even bigger English attack, and they ran away. So, you know, incredibly brave. That could have gone the way of Thermopylae as well, but didn't. So, I'm sorry, every time you're going to do an element of bravery, I'm going to say Edward did equal or more, and he fought in more battles and he won more battles. And I think that, you know, Leonidas, I think we all have a soft spot for, but if you're going to look at sheer number of wins versus number of wins, well, yeah, that's where we are.
Obviously, I knew that if we were going to start bringing maths into the equation...
yeah, I'm using facts and maths, and you've got a fuzzy feeling.
It would be... I mean, at the end of the day, let's not forget that Edward, at the start of his reign, had a claim to be King of France. He eventually had to renounce that claim as he went through his life. You know, he didn't hold on to every, you know, that's a pretty big, if we're talking about, you know, having to give things up and having to lose things, pretty big thing to drop up to say, no, okay, I'm going to renounce my claim as King of France. That's a pretty big loss. But also I'm going to do a little bit of defense of Leonidas here, because we keep, you keep coming back and you're referring to him making this loss as though for a start this was some sort of tactical blunder that for some reason, you know, and I think there was a tactical error, but the error was not that of Leonidas. Leonidas never wanted to be fighting in that pass in the first place. If he'd had his way, he would have done the sensible warrior thing, and he would have said, right, let's let Athens fall. Okay, we don't, you know, you've got to take your battles, pick your battles, let Athens fall because it's far too vulnerable, and then we can come back and we can win the war. You know, this is the way wars are normally thought. But of course, because he was leading not just a Spartan army, but because he was the leader, he was running a massed combined force of Greece's armies. You know, he's not just leading his own army. He is leading the massed armies of Greece. He then also has to defer to one of the other biggest armies. They're not going to let their own city-state fall to the Persians. And so they then come up with the fallback plan, which involves the Greeks needing to take out the ships of the Persian fleet. That was the main thing they had to do. But in order to do that, they also had to delay this huge Persian army. And Leonidas, he decided that the thing to do was delay this army and not to take every single soldier he had and battle out and risk losing. You know, he probably could have won on that battlefield. He probably could have won a Pyrrhic victory. He probably could have won a victory where, you know, they could have killed, you know, many, many more. He probably could even have won, but he would have lost a lot of his own troops. And as you say, there was still infighting among Greece. He didn't want to lose the entire Spartan army defending the entirety of Greece from Persia, and then turn around the next minute and find out that he had wiped out his entire army. Athens still had theirs. They were lost. So he actually refused to take extra forces from the Spartans. He only took his 300 Spartans, and he went ahead, and when they fought that battle, he knew when he was going that he probably wasn't going to make it. He knew that he was a delaying tactic. That was his job. His job was to slow down that advance. He did that for 2 days. They killed thousands of the opposition troops. He did his job in that battle. Now, you talk about winning and losing. Yes, in a classic sense of battle, they lost. They didn't make it, but sometimes the point of a battle, the point of an army, the point of a particular tactic, you get people that go into battle and they know they're not going to make it out. That's not part of what they do. And in fact, many, many Hollywood films are based on the heroic actions of somebody who knows that they're going in for that last minute fight, you know, holding people off. They know they're not going to make it. And that is held up as a thing of heroism. That is why he's not just someone that lost a battle, but that they are, you know, the legends that they are. Because he went out there, he was following his beliefs, he's following the Spartan beliefs that you battle, he wasn't going to surrender, he wasn't going to run away, and his army did their job in order to, you know, hold off that battle, hold off the invaders for 2 days, weaken them. That was his army's job. That was what they went into battle for. So in that sense, he did achieve the goal. Yes, a loss in sort of military straight on, this is what a battle does forms, but his fight did what it was supposed to do.
Remind me what happened to Athens after this battle.
Right, okay, that's not the point. That was the other people. His army did their job. That was my point.
No, he didn't. You said it was to stop them from getting to Athens and get it so sacked, which is exactly what happened. You know, it's the other... you're right. You know, it was a brave last stand. You know, he was woefully outnumbered. It wasn't 300 against a million. It was actually about 2,000 against maybe about 90,000. But that is still heavily, heavily outnumbered. You know,
if we're going to go into actually talking facts, it was about 6,300 people that he actually had. This is the thing. When you talk about him, you do only mention the number of Spartans he had. You ignore the other 6,000
yes,
troops he probably
had. Well, I've heard 2,000, you've heard 6,000. So yeah, but I mean, look, they were heavily, heavily outnumbered. There's no doubt about that. But it was also the battles of Salamis and Artemisia, and then later on, the sort of like year later at Plataea, that these are the ones that actually turned back, that actually kicked the Persians out. Okay? He slowed them down for 3 days and he was very brave. If we had an argument about who's the bravest, you'd win. If you had an argument about who's the most legendary, you'd win. But that's not what we're arguing about. We're about the greatest warrior. And if we're talking about warrior king, and if we're talking about time in battles, I win. If we talk about victories, I win. If we talk about legacy of the time, they're probably even Stevens, although it is worth pointing out that it's the other guys that did the hard lifting in your case, and it was Edward leading armies or getting his son to lead armies that were doing the heavy lifting in my case. So, you know, it obviously, as always, we'll leave this to the listeners to decide.
Actually, I'm gonna interrupt you there, Jim, because I will say that you've made some wonderful points, and I think
I'm waiting for the but.
I think if this was any other discussion we were having now, or if I had chosen any other warrior king to hold up, at this point in time, I might well declare that you have actually made a better case than I have, and I may well hand over victory to you in the light and the sheer quantity of facts and information and battles you have there. However, having said that, in honour of Leonidas and the fact that he made that stand with that very, very small number of troops and he didn't give up and he went down fighting, Jem, I think I will allow you to claim victory, although for the sake of Leonidas, I will not be conceding it.
Oh, what a beautiful way to wrap that one up. Okay, I like that one. I'll take that. Thank you very much, Greg. Also, you guys have, it wasn't actually Leonidas who said this, but it is a famous quote from that battle. The Persians threatened the Greeks by saying, we have so many archers, our arrows will blot out the sun. And the response was, good, then we will fight in the shade, which is like an action movie moment. It is genuinely in the movie 300, but it sounds like it's made up by Hollywood script writers. It isn't. It's just a really cool line. And I can't respond with that. Well, I've got the line about talking about his son, let the boy earn his spurs, which is pretty cool. One last thing about Edward. After the Battle of Crecy, he founded the Knights of the Garter. And the Order of the Garter is still around. It's what the most prestigious association probably in the world. Basically, it's something that the Queen can choose personal friends. It's not something she's obliged to do. And the only other way you can get to it is if you're an ex-prime minister. That's about as exclusive a club as you're ever going to get. But it was something that all these other chivalric orders were based off of. He came up with the idea first. So both fascinating characters, wouldn't you agree?
I would certainly agree that we chose a nice selection there and a nice range. But, Jim, it is very quickly time to shove in our plugs and get this podcast wrapped up.
Okay, right. Well, I know we're approaching Christmas, guys, so what better Christmas present for the history geek in your life or the lover of good drama and writing? Check out Silent Crossroads, my first self-published historical novel, available via Amazon, either as an ebook or a paperback. It's about Harry Woods, the only British soldier who fought in both world wars on both sides. There's love, there's drama, there's excitement, there's politics, as history. There's a little bit of something for everybody there. I've got really good reviews on Amazon. If you have read it, please perhaps add your own review. It started strong, but I could always do with some more. That's all from me.
And I will say, if you can head over to www.condensedhistories.com, you can find out everything that's going on with me, because I've got no idea what's happening by the time this comes out. It might be airship related, it might be something entirely different when this one comes out. But that is all from me and my fabulous co-host. So thank you very much to Mr. Jim DeLuccia.
And to Mr. Greg Chapman.
And thank you very much for listening, everyone. Thank you so much for all your comments, reviews. Thank you for those messages that come into us. And goodbye, and take care.